You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Coming to you live from Studio One here in London, this is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up...
Liebe Freunde, meine Damen und Herren, man braucht nicht drumherum.
Angela Merkel wins a fourth term as German Chancellor, but with a far-right party entering the Bundestag for the first time in nearly 60 years, is it a hollow victory? Plus, what about Brexit?
We are also flexible as to whether the benefits of the single market are best retained by negotiating a new single market relationship or by working up from a bespoke trade deal. The outcome is what matters.
Britain's Labour Party conference reveals little about how that party might navigate the rough waters of negotiation with the European Union. My guests, Quentin Peel and Mary Beyond, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Japan's snap election. How will the lingering threat of North Korea impact voter sentiment? And with yet more mass demonstrations in Catalonia, we'll ask how serious the secession movement could become. That's all ahead on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests today are indeed Mary Beyond, UK correspondent for French media, and Quentin Peel, associate fellow at Chatham House and contributor for the Financial Times. A warm welcome both to the programme. As the world reacted to Angela Merkel's election victory, thoughts quickly turned to another somewhat alarming development. For the first time since 1961, a far-right political party will join the Bundestag, with nearly half of all voters turning away from Germany two largest parties. Quentin, I'll come to you first of all, your erstwhile base, of course, in Germany. Was this a hollow victory? The headline in Bild was nightmare win for Merkel. Does that somehow describe this? What's happened at the ballot boxes?
Nightmare is a pretty strong word, but it's certainly a setback, a shock. It's going to present her with a really tough negotiation to try and get no less than three parties into a coalition, actually four parties into a coalition, because she's going to have trouble not just accommodating the Liberals and the Greens, but also her own sister party in Bavaria, which can't stand either the Liberals or the Greens. So somehow she's got to do a lot of peacemaking. The other side of it clearly is this advent of the Alternative for Germany, the far-right party in the German Bundestag. I'm not 100% sure that in itself is such a disaster. This is a party that has made an awful fool of itself as well. They're constantly bickering. They don't have any clear direction. On the other hand, symbolically, it is a shock to the system that the far right are in the Bundestag.
And just on that point, before we move on, this idea of AfD, some people say, look, you're almost better off. We've seen it in some of the Nordic nations, having far right parties actually head for the front line of politics, because it shows up the fact that they're not very capable politicians, they can't get things done, and in a way it brings fresh scrutiny, which then prompts the public to say, oh, I'm not sure we want them back again. Could that happen in Germany?
I think this, looking at the bright side, this could be quite a salutary shock for German politics. We've had three goes even in recent years of this grand coalition of the two major parties, supposedly the two parties that really dictate the divide in Germany, actually getting together in government. And that always encourages the extremes. Now, after this election, the Social Democrats are going to go into opposition. And I think that actually that's very healthy. It will create a much more vigorous debate across the centre-right, centre-left. And that in itself might take some steam out of the more extreme parties. So that would be the positive thing, that actually this is underneath quite good for German democracy.
Murray, if we look back then to the sort of the genesis of Alternative for Deutschland's success, a lot of people said, look, you know, Merkel showed leadership. If we look, for example, during the refugee crisis, made this big play, Germany was open, led by example, and was quite knowing that would cost her potentially politically. Is this a case of those chickens slightly coming home to roost, do you think?
Well, yes, it has to be, because if, I mean, It's a general trend in Europe that the extreme are in the rise. And there might have been a rise even if Merkel didn't do what she did. But she was the politician that was supposed to unite Germany. And there was a very interesting piece in the Sunday paper yesterday saying that because of this migrant crisis, Angela Merkel reignited the old division that was during the Cold War, with the East not being used to have so many immigrants and people coming from abroad arriving all of a sudden with this immigration crisis, while the West was used to have migrants because they used to have people from the East basically fleeing to the West, and the West being more than at ease with this coming of people and the East being less. So she was supposed to be the uniting factor, and she failed in a way in that. But this, it's something that we see also a lot with the negotiation of Brexit. Angela Merkel is a politician, and she's a very astute politician because she doesn't look like one. But at the same time, she seems to have quite very important principle that she doesn't want to sacrifice. And Germany, being a welcoming country, is very important for her. And although I don't think she thought that she would basically jeopardize a career out of that, it was quite important, I think, for her and for her standing in the world to be seen as, again, as for many things, leading the way in the way other European countries couldn't or didn't have the political strength to do.
And Quentin, on that point, it's interesting that Murray raised there about Merkel as this sort of unifier. And we had it with Macron, where he talked after his success in France about, you know, I'm going to deliver rhetoric which will bring back those who've abandoned the centre ground and gone to Le Pen. I can bring them back. Merkel again said, I can make an inclusive house here for those who've maybe turned to the AfD. And if you look at it, a lot of them were first-time voters, I think up towards 750,000, which is a big number. Can Merkel lure those sorts of people? Maybe they're disaffected with the political mainstream, whatever their motivation. Can she be the person to lure them back?
Well, I think that she's got to change her tactics, actually. Her tactics up to now, which have been very successful at grabbing the centre ground, have been never be too confrontational, never argue too furiously with your opponents, but steal some of their best policies and take the centre ground. And that has been absolutely critical in weakening the Social Democrats. But it hasn't worked against the Alternative for Germany, I think. And there, of course, they're very angry people there. We've seen in this election campaign more shouting and screaming at rallies of Angela Merkel than I ever remember in a German election campaign. Really quite angry and hostile people. And somebody was saying to me, the trouble is Merkel has now become quite a divisive figure. Now, I think you're always going to get 10-12% of any European electorate who are fairly hardline nationalist, populist, anti-immigrant, perhaps. We got it in Britain and so on. The question is not to allow that figure to grow, really. Mm. There, I think Merkel has up to now been successful. The challenge for her now is, with this difficult coalition she's going to have, a centre-right liberal coalition on the one hand, a green coalition with quite a certain left-wing views on the other, can she actually come up with a strategy that wins some of those voters back from the AfD?
Emery, that's an interesting point, isn't it? There's been talk of this Jamaica coalition of black and gold and green, which is an attractive image on a day when we've seen some rather appetizing images, certainly from the AfD side of things. Are people just trying to find a positive, or do you think that that does offer a way forward?
Well, I guess it's a bit of both. People want to see, people want change, and the SDP CDU-CSU coalition was there for a long time, so it's not going to happen. The SDP said it's going to go into the opposition bench. That's something that's not going to happen again for this election. So this new coalition, I mean, it's very different from the forming of a coalition. It's so different in Germany than it is in the UK. In the UK, it's a few days. It's very worrying if it's more than a week when you have basically an agreement or a coalition. In Germany, if it was less than a week, it would be completely crazy that it would have, that the coalition could be built in such a short time. It's going to take a lot of time to build a coalition, because they are going to present a program to the nation. And although there might not be any kind of election, I think they still have to present something and not just basically go along and decide, oh, maybe we'll do that, maybe we won't do that. They'll have to have a program. So that's something that people are going to be waiting to hear from. And it's very interesting because, in a way, when there's a coalition in the UK, you just do with the political forces that have been elected somehow. Whereas there, the politicians will have the possibility to reflect about the results of the election, see what trends and what kind of reaction the people have to these results, and then present a coalition proposition that's going to be relevant to the mood of the people after the election. And as we've seen recently in Europe, elections can basically bring a lot of surprises to politicians. So it's good that it takes time, that they have time to basically just recover from the shock, think about and see what's happening in the country, and then present something a bit cold-headed.
But I think there's a problem here for Merkel because, OK, if you tried to respond to the election results, you might suggest then she should get tougher on immigration or find out tougher rules. Mm-hmm. But actually, she's got partners in government, in the Greens and to a degree in the socially liberal Free Democrats, who are not really inclined to say, really get very restrictive on immigration. So she'll be pulled in both directions. Her Bavarian sister party want tough rules on immigration. The Greens don't want tough rules on immigration. A very difficult balancing act.
Tricky balancing acts domestically, Quentin. We're going to talk in a second about Brexit and Britain. But just on the European-wide viewpoint from Merkel, obviously people are quick to say, does this change the Brexit dynamic? Does it change the European dynamic? You know, we've talked about Merkel looking more and more like the last of an era that's gone, the last leader. Will this prompt any kind of, I don't know, concern about the appetite, say, for broader European reform, given that maybe she's weakened a little domestically?
Yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, I think a grand coalition in Germany, again, with the Social Democrats, would have fitted much better with Emmanuel Macron in France, wanting to have reform in the Eurozone, less austerity, new rules for a common budget and so on. The Free Democrats in the new coalition are going to be very hostile to all of that. So it's going to make a sort of big leap forward for the European Union more difficult. On Brexit, and we'll come to that, I don't think it's going to change anything. I think all three parties, actually, they all agree with Angela Merkel. We don't want to endanger the integrity of the single market or the unity of the EU27. That's the highest priority. The Brits are going to have to accept it.
Anne-Marie, would you go along that from a French perspective, we're looking at potential reform agenda for Europe. Would you sort of broadly agree with what Quentin has to say there?
Yes, very much so. Yes. The Macron said that he's going to go on and push his agenda for European reform, but it's going to be less easy, for sure. He's got good relation with the SPD. His party had good relation with the SPD, so SDP. So yeah, it's going to be more complicated, but I don't think it's too daunting for him. I mean, it seems to be quite happy to play. He has to be seen as being happy to talk with new players. He's himself a new player in the political scene in Europe, so he's got to basically stay positive and say, well, these are new players, we're going to go along with them and see what's going to happen. So in the face of it, not too much of a problem. In the nitty-gritty of it, yeah, might be a bit more complicated.
Well, we've heard a little bit about some of the challenges ahead for Merkel. Problems one imagines that Theresa May would rather like to have, given her domestic political travails. But as Quentin just said, and other analysts agree, that result in Germany probably makes little difference vis-a-vis Brexit. Meanwhile, though, in Britain today, today's Labour Party conference revealed rather vague generalities about the exit from the bloc, although some senior figures seemed to suggest almost that a second referendum could be a possibility somewhere down the line. Marie, obviously, you've been in the country charting these developments as well. Should we be surprised that there is a bit of a lack of clarity at a forum like, for example, the Labour Party conference?
Especially not in the Labour Party conference, because they are, at the moment, a very, well, divided party in terms of the electorate. They are elected, Corbyn has been elected by very young people who are very much pro-European, who are working in startups, who wants to basically travel the world, who are very open-minded and very they baby Europeans, basically, the 20, 30-something. And at the same time, they've been elected as well very strongly by people perhaps a bit more in the north, people who are afraid of immigration, who are way more sceptic. So, and Jeremy Corbyn, and many people think that maybe perhaps there's going to be an election somewhere down the line not too far away, and he doesn't want to jeopardize his base and his two-faced base, basically. So it was obvious that the Labour Party is going to be trading on very difficult salt, trying not to alienate any of the electorate. Theresa May has to somehow, if she wants to keep on advancing on Brexit, she has somehow to displease more or less one part of his government, the anti-Brexit, and please another one, and try and basically balance the act by sometimes pleasing the one, pleasing the other. But Labour doesn't have to do that. That's the luxury of being in opposition. You can say a lot of things and try not to alienate anyone. So even if it's a few days conference, I'm sure, and even on Wednesday when Jeremy Corbyn is going to do his big speech, I would be surprised if we are any more advanced in the position of Labour on Brexit. Although talking about staying into the single market seems to be now their new motto, but there's so few position on how it will be done that it's not too controversial even towards the Eurosceptic base, I think.
Well, and Quentin, there's the rub, isn't it? We've also got the delegations in Brussels getting the, whatever it is, fourth round. Are we already up that
fourth
far?
Round.
And what we're still lacking, it seems, is detail. Again, there's generalities, as Marie's described. Yes, there seems to be a broader acceptance, almost rather passively, that some form of continuing access to single market will continue for a period of time. Are you concerned still about the lack of detail, progress on that front?
Yes, absolutely. I think I would call this the fourth round of non-negotiations. Mm. They're not really negotiating with each other because the British government doesn't know what it wants. And so we've got this extraordinary situation where the government is split and doesn't know what it wants, and the opposition is split and doesn't know what it wants.
So where do we look? We're confused, we're frustrated. We want a progressive agenda from somebody. Who's going to deliver this, Quentin? I'm worried.
Up till now, they were saying Angela Merkel's going to deliver it for us. I think after the German election results, they've realised that Angela Merkel is going to be tied up in her own knots for the next 6 months. So it's really difficult. And just as Marie was saying, I mean, for the Labour Party, to remain ambiguous is brilliant. But for the government to remain ambiguous is actually extremely difficult, because the people on the other side of the table are saying, look, what do you want? And the Brits keep saying, well, why don't you tell us what we want? It's very weird.
Where do you think, Mary, then, where do we look for something to give here? Because one imagines it could be, you've already alluded to, you know, a potential election domestically in the UK at some point. If people lose confidence in Theresa May, for example, do we have to wait for her personal position to become untenable? Is that when we're going to get movement? If you look into the tea leaves, what do they tell you?
Oh, well, I have tea just here. It doesn't tell me anything. Well, I don't know. I mean, Theresa May leaving, yes, but who would replace her? Boris Johnson? Maybe. Yes, that's a possibility. That's something that he's been thinking about.
Maybe not the progressive unifier I had in mind.
Yes, that's the thing, yeah. So, well, and he would be the only one who might be able to take after her. So, okay, so Boris Johnson, there will be hard Brexit. Oh, well, would it? Because, you know, he's not in opposition himself, but he's kind of in, isn't he? He's the foreign secretary, but he's not in charge of Brexit, although he was at the forefront of the battle for Brexit. So he's got a very cozy position. He can say whatever he wants. We saw that recently, because she can't fire him and he's not in charge of anything. So he can say, and it's a bit like Labour, basically. He can say whatever he wants. But if he got the power, that's going to be more complicated. Makes me think, not wanting to compare at all the policy of Boris Johnson and Marine Le Pen in France. Not at all in that sense. But if it's or perhaps her father, maybe, because he didn't want the power, because he knew he would have to do something about it. Boris Johnson, if he had the power, he would have to do something about it. And Boris Johnson is not well known he's not a doer. He's not reputed to be a doer. Again, not wanting to compare Boris Johnson and Marine Le Pen or even Jean-Marie Le Pen, but just in that sense, that he's happy, and I think in the way he doesn't have to make any decision. If there's an election, if it's not just Boris Johnson taking over after Theresa May or anyone else or Hammond or anyone, and if it is Jeremy Corbyn is going to have to take a few decisions. And the problem is that Jeremy Corbyn is not exactly a Europhile, a very strong Europhile. He's more of a Eurosceptic. But his Keir Starmer is more of a Europhile, and his business secretary is, well, it's very complicated. It's got so many people he has to please as well. So if there was a change, there would be a distraction, a change at the head of government. There would be another distraction like the June election. We really don't need that. Although perhaps maybe we want to stall Brexit. So basically in a few years' time, all the Brexiters will be, sorry to say that, dead because they were a bit old. And we can think about it again because the younger people will be able to vote again. I don't know. I'm just being a bit, you know, nasty about it.
No, questions I'm sure everyone's raised. Quinn, just before we move on, one last thought. It's interesting. In this country, we had a lot of rhetoric about putting Britain first again. Obviously, Trump has his America first thing. But you look at all of the things we've been talking about, and even the German elections to a degree, the success of AfD and scepticism about immigration, this sort of thing. Do even sort of the moral leadership that someone like Merkel has displayed, for her successors, whoever they might be, is that going to be harder to do? You know, will there be now more pressure because people will look at what's politically expedient and say, well, no, you know, the German leadership needs to have a Germany first message, you know, and does that prove a longer term challenge for the European project again if all of the nations are governed by what is expedient within their own borders?
I think that nationalism comes and goes in phases. I think that when we had the financial crash 2008, my instinctive reaction to that was, oh my God, we're going to see nationalism return, because everybody will say the solution to this global crisis is put up the barriers, defend yourselves and so on. And for a while, we stemmed that actually and held it back. But I think that's the nationalist, if you like, tides that we're seeing. Now, tide may be too strong a word, but it's an instinctive reaction to say, find the examples locally. And that's where, of course, the tension in Europe is so critical, because the European Union is, by definition, the sort of post-nationalist, after nationalism, we can pool sovereignty. And the Brits have voted against it. The truth is that Brexit vote, of course, actually strengthened the feeling pro the European Union in every other member state. Fascinating. I've just spent a month in Ireland. 88% of the Irish are pro-EU now, in spite of Brexit.
Let's move on. With the Japanese opposition reportedly in disarray, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe hopes a snap election might cement his position as he stares down a mounting threat posed by North Korea, amongst other problems. But despite the government's confidence, a failure to win a majority would lead to the probable resignation of the Prime Minister and leave the whole nation, like its opposition, in some disarray. Marie-Bion, what do you make of this? Do you think it's a reasonable assumption and a fairly sensible political calculation that Abe has presumably made that broadly the Japanese voters will sort of side with him?
At the moment, it's never a reasonable assumption to think that the voters are going to side with you if you live in government. I mean, it seems a bit weird at the moment when there's such an international crisis that involves Japan so directly that the head of the power basically thinks about putting his job on the market. It seems like it doesn't sound very responsible. And it does sound as well as if he wants to distract people from what's happening in North Korea. Because, of course, when there's an election, you think about, well, election, and you want the election to be about something, and the voters want it to be about something else. And that might be something that politicians in Japan want to see happening, so that we fear less about what's happening in North Korea and the relation between North Korea and the US, which, as we saw today, is still escalating rapidly. So I'm a bit, you know, I'm a bit amazed of this to this announcement today. The thing is, of course, if he can strengthen his hand, and I'm quoting someone, I'm not going to say who, it's Theresa May, of course, and he manages to do that, that might be interesting for him in the country, but that won't change anything. Kim Jong-un won't just don't care the last puppy about it.
But in fact, we've just been talking about nationalism, and here isn't Shinzo Abe really trying to ride a bit of a nationalist tide because of the threat of North Korea? And here he is in a situation where he doesn't have to call an election for another year, but he's riding very high in the polls, 44% support, and the next highest is 8%, this 36% lead. Now, don't get overconfident. Look what happened to Theresa May. And actually, what is going to be very interesting, and at least personalities may be in it, because we've got the governor of Tokyo, this really very successful Yuriko Koike, an ex-member of Shinzo Abe's party, but now much more touchy-feely, and did very well in the Tokyo elections. She's thrown her hat in the ring. She's launched her party called the Party of Hope. It could dent Mr. Abe's sort of riding the tide of nationalism to victory. He's not a very much loved figure, and she's much more exciting, really.
And Quint, on that point about the personalities here, should he be successful, Abe would wind up, I think, being Japan's longest-serving prime minister since the war, and potentially further back than that. What would that tell us about modern Japan, if anything, in your view?
Well, he has been quite nationalist in his policy throughout, more openly so, and he's keeping doing that. His theme for this election, quite interestingly in that place to the same thing, is reviving the Japanese birth rate, dealing with the crisis of an aging population. You know, we must have more babies. Guess what? That's also, go back to the beginning of our conversation, one of the slogans of the AfD in Germany. We want more German babies. So I think it shows he's been quite successful at that. It may also show that the Japanese, you know, they've had a long, long period of very slow zero growth, really, and there's a feeling that the whole country is stagnating. Are they actually, have they chosen somebody who at least offers long-term stability? I don't know.
Well, let's touch briefly down back in Europe before the end of the programme. Polling in Spain suggests voters in Catalonia are evenly split over the region's upcoming referendum on secession. The majority of people would prefer the issue be settled by a vote. It's a stark contrast to the Spanish government view. They've described it as invalid. Organisers will be fined up to €12,000 a day until they abandon the movement. Marie Bion, the vote is due to be held soon, and Catalans will be asked, do you want Catalonia to be an independent country in the form of a republic? They'll give their answer, even though they know that it may not change anything. Has there been misjudgments here by the pro-Catalan independence lobby, by Spain's government? How do you read it?
Well, it's true that people want to have a say on that, but they want to have a say legally. So many people who want to have a say say that now is not the good time. The way it's being organised is not the good way of it to be organised, because it's going to burn our ammunition for some time. I guess those who won the independence got just fed up and thought that Madrid will never ever give them a referendum, and that we might as well go and see how it goes. And if there's a good turnout and if the results are positive for independence, then we're gonna force Madrid's hand. But in a way, it alienated some of the people who might have been in favour of independence, but don't want to see the independence being agreed in that sense. So I'm not sure that was a good calculation. And we'll see about the turnout. The problem is Madrid has answered so forcefully, saying that she's going to take over the police force to see what's going to happen during the poll day, that it might have alienated back some people who thought, well, I don't want to vote in this referendum, and now think, well, the way Madrid is reacting, I might want to vote to this referendum because I don't want to do anything with Madrid or with this way of dealing with democracy. So I'm not a specialist of Spain either, so it's more, I'm more interested about the feelings toward the independence, because having covered the Scottish referendum, feelings were extremely important. It was more important than economy, and it still is very much so in Scotland, very important. The feelings, the wish to be independent, and the way London reacted and the way it conducted the campaign was extremely important to Scottish people, and I think that's the same somehow on the other side in the south.
At Quentin, time rather short. In a few seconds, it is interesting, that comparison with the Scottish vote, of course. Is there a degree to which countries or regions get quite close to the finishing line line and a bit of jitters and that sense that you're better off sticking with what you know. Didn't work with Brexit, but do you think that that could be a factor this weekend?
Yes, if you remember Quebec, just at the line they pulled back. I don't know what's going to happen this weekend. I suspect it's going to be very messy because they've seized half the ballot papers and everything. But I totally agree with Mary. The danger is Madrid, I think, has overplayed their hand. They make people angry, and the British government nearly did that in Scotland, nearly lost it by being so aggressive. That's not the way to deal with a would-be nationalist movement.
Indeed, wise words. As always, from both Quentin Peel and Marie Beyond, thank you both very much for being our guests here on Midori House today. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maddie Speed, and our studio manager was David Stevens. My name's Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for tuning in.